And what we also know about TAFE commitment is that students who have a goal to be lifelong musicians, they tend to live that out. They stick at it. You know, students who say, "Oh, I'm just going to play till the end of this year," they don't practice as much. They don't progress as much. So having a long-term commitment is important.
You're watching Tim Topham TV. This is episode number 30. Hi everyone, and welcome to my little piano studio today. I was down here recording a webinar anyway, so I thought, I might as well do my intro for this week's episode down here while I'm here. Today's episode is all about practice, motivation, and mindset, and I'm talking to a very special guest, Michael Griffin. Now, getting students to practice can be really challenging, especially as they get older and more overscheduled. In fact, practice and getting students to practice was the number one thing that teachers mentioned as a personal challenge in my teaching survey in January. And as you know, we're in the middle of, actually we're at the start of, Practice and Motivation Month on timtopham.com. So in this episode, I interview one of the leading experts on motivation in music, Michael Griffin, to get some ideas about how motivation and the role of parents can help students have more success in their lessons and in their home practice. Michael Griffin is an educator, speaker, author, conductor, and pianist. His talks are inspired by the theory of motivation and the premise that the greatest predictor of progress, music and otherwise, is the quality and quantity of practice time. And that's why this is so important for all of us. He's spoken in schools in 25 countries, including Australia, USA, Malaysia, Africa, England, New Zealand, and eminent schools like Scotch College, Eton College, and the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, to name just a few of the places that he has presented. He's particularly interested in teaching metacognition and the influence of mindset on achievement. He's consulted for Cambridge University Press and is the author of 5 books, the most recent being Learning Strategies for Musical Success, which we will talk about later on. Now, this is a fantastic interview. We really get into some of the philosophies and the nuts and bolts about practice and why kids don't do it and whether they are actually too overscheduled or whether there's other reasons for it. We talk about the role of parents and all sorts of different things that I know will be of help to you in regarding getting your students to practice more and more efficiently too. Now, I've got a great download for you today too on the show notes page. And this is a little package of some of my main practice resources that I use for my students. So there's some cheat sheets, there's some lists of ways that I like students to practice to give you just a whole lot of different ideas that you can give the kids. So these are things that you can have either with the piano or you can give to students, whatever it is. Some of the notes I've sent home to parents about practice and some notes from some of the books I've read about practice too. So I want to share all this with you guys. It's all free. On the show notes page, you'll find the download little box there. So it's at timtopham.com/episode30. Jump on there, have a look at the notes and the links that we've got from this interview with Michael. And you can also download my special practice pack. Make sure too, as usual, I'd love for you to leave an iTunes review if you get a chance. The instructions are all at timtopham.com/iTunes. And otherwise, I think we should just get into the interview. I do hope you enjoy this interview with Michael Griffin, all about motivation, mindset, and practice.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to have you on the show finally.
Great to be here, Tim.
All right. So look, as I've mentioned in the introduction, the biggest number one problem by far from my survey of all my readers and listeners is getting students to practice. And I know you're the man with all the solutions to our problem. Well, at least some ideas anyway. But I wanted to just give you some of the statements that I actually got in my survey, because I think some of them are actually quite funny, but they're really heartfelt. And I know that this is a big pain point for everyone. And look, I put my hand up. I'm no kind of wizard here. I struggle to get my students to practice just as much as anyone. So some of the replies were, in regard to practice, inspiring them to practice consistently was a problem. Motivating without being a dragon was funny, I thought. Encouraging students to find the time to practice in the midst of all the activities they have to do and helping train parents in how to help their students set up consistent practice times. avoiding their lessons becoming their practice sessions each week, we've all had that one, and helping students tailor a home practice program that's inspiring, efficient, and doable with their overscheduled lives and less than perfect home practice environments and instruments. So that's what everyone is saying, and I thank you so. Got to thank my readers and listeners who have put the time into responding to that survey. Thank you so much. Let's hope that today we can give them some great ideas. So, I guess the ultimate question is, Michael, why don't kids practice?
Well, gee, that's the million-dollar question, Tim, and it's something that I endeavour to explore and continue to explore, like everybody else, and try and understand. Essentially, though, in my opinion, it boils down to the fuel of human behaviour. You know, why do we do anything? What underpins our choices and our actions? It's motivation. So personally, I think motivation's got to be an overarching concern, and it is, isn't it, for parents and for teachers.
Absolutely.
Why do people do what they do? And motivation, if we get it right, motivation creates in us a desire to overcome obstacles, to persist beyond the boundaries of comfort, to work harder, and to achieve greater than we thought was possible and perhaps our teachers thought was possible.
Mm.
But there's a lot of elements to this. Firstly, I think the fourth point you mentioned was about parents.
Yes, yeah. Well, there's a number of comments about that.
You know, there's an old saying, kids might not listen to what their parents say, but they sure as hell imitate them, you know. And so the first thing is the values of the family, the values that the parents bring into this, because children do take on the values of their parents. And that might even be insisting upon a practice routine. One thing we know for sure, Tim, is why do kids give up music? Well, it gets back to motivation. The greatest motivator is making progress. It's as simple as that. And Harvard University study on motivation, the greatest motivator is making progress. And if kids don't make progress, they're going to give up. Now, let's take that to the next line. How do you make progress as a musician? Well, it's clear. The greatest predictor of musical progress is the quality and the quantity of your practice time. That's where it's at. There's no magic bullet. And that leads into a whole area of attribution theory. Why are you good at what you do? And unfortunately, there's an elephant in the room with music education, because a lot of people in our world think it's about natural ability. And if you're talented, you don't have to practice.
Mm.
Right? So maybe we'll talk about growth mindset a bit later.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely on my list. From reading about what you're talking about, and also interestingly, even in my own experience as a teacher in a school, there's a lot of talk about motivation and the concept of a growth mindset. So we'll get to that. I wanted to ask you about this being a little bit of a chicken and an egg thing, though, isn't it? You have to do the practice to get motivated, but the motivation is lacking if you don't do the practice, and so you kind of go around in circles a bit.
Well, I think that's why the act of becoming a musician is a great testament to character, because it requires persistence, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It requires stick additiveness. And part of that is, again, if we go to fundamental intrinsic motivation theory, intrinsic motivation theory is based on a simple tripartite model, and one of those is competence. Why do people give up music? Fragile competence beliefs. They don't believe they can get any better. Now, once people think they're no good at something, they will stop putting work into that.
Mm.
And children will stop practicing, right? So the first thing, one thing I'd say is we teachers need to give students the tools for making progress, which means we have to teach them how to practice and explain why it works. Now, with great respect to the music education fraternity, what I observe is teachers refer to practice, but that's not enough. It's not explicit.
So let's say you need to practice bars, you know, 1 to 8 of this, off you go. And that's the limit of it.
Well, let's get down to the what are the golden nuggets of practice? See, for me, it's three things. Repetition. Now, Repetition is vastly underestimated. Most people underestimate how many repetitions it takes to secure a phrase of music, right? Repetition is the mother of learning, you know, the old repetitio est mater studiorum. Aristotle, we become our repeated selves. Norman Doidge, the brain that changes itself. It becomes what you do with it. The brain is plastic. It changes through experience, right? New connections are formed with repetition, and once is never enough. So the first thing is repetition. The second thing, and this might differ depending on the instrument, but slow practice is extraordinarily important. Mm. The brain loves slow learning. And we could go into these points in a lot more detail. You might know, Tim, I talk about this stuff in schools and with parents as well. We want parents to understand how it works so they can support their children. But the third thing is chunking, just working on a little bit at a time. Now, what do teachers observe when they watch their students practice? If they do, because most don't, but if they do,
start to finish, surely.
Yeah, once. Well, yeah. Gary McPherson's study, 85% of students under the age of 14, the way they practice is they go from the start to the finish and they play it through once without stopping to fix anything.
85% of under
14. Well, 80 or 85%. Well, yeah, still, it's in my book. I can't remember the figure, but it's 80 to 85%.
Yeah.
It's horrifying.
Yeah. It's just such a waste of time. I tell my students who are mostly teenagers and have even less time perhaps than a 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old might do, you know, if you want to make progress, you have such little limited time. Let's use that time effectively. Don't waste a minute of it because you don't have a minute of it to waste.
Yeah.
But it is hard to get through. It really is. You have to repeat it and demonstrate it. And maybe you've got some ideas about how to actually, you know, try and make that sink in.
Mm. Well, I think the third phrase, you just mentioned the word demonstrate. You know, modeling is a very powerful way to teach a skill. In fact, it could be the most effective way to teach a skill. Some of your listeners might be familiar with the books by Tim Gerway, The Inner Game of Golf and The Inner Game of Tennis. And, you know, Gerway says he's teaching people how to serve and couldn't get through with verbal explanation. And so he decided to zip it and just throw the ball up and say, now you do that. Now, we walk and we talk through modelling, through copying people. Mimicry is still the super skill of learning skills, right?
Yeah.
The meta skill, I should say, mimicry. So you take the concept of slow practice, for example. Now, my teacher, and I loved him dearly and he was well-intentioned, but I only ever got told to go home and practice that slowly. I didn't really know what it meant, and most kids don't. They think it starts at andante, right?
Mm.
And they find it very hard to do. The only way to teach slow practice is to model it.
Yep.
You know? And music teachers, we tend to be fairly verbose. We try and verbally explain so many concepts where sometimes a simple model would be more powerful. So, and I had an experience. I was doing a workshop in Luxembourg a few years ago, and this kid was playing the G minor prelude of Rachmaninoff, dum da da da, boom boom, right? And you could tell that he needed to practice it a bit slower. So I said, do you mind if I have a go? And I played it very slowly. And you might remember, Rachmaninoff was he loved slow practice.
He used a great exponent. Hmm.
And so I played it really slowly, and I said to the lad, now, can you have a go? Can you play it that fast or that slowly? And he couldn't. It took four goes before he actually copied my tempo correctly.
Mm,
mm. That was a bit of a light bulb moment for me. I thought, I think maybe I'd previously assumed that people just copied correctly. And perhaps it's their hearts beat faster, Tim. Maybe that's one of the reasons. They also see progress in their music as playing something fast. Maybe it's counterproductive to play it slowly.
There's definitely an element of that.
Yeah, we need to provide a rationale for slow practice. You know, why do you practice slowly? Well, mistake avoidance is an obvious one.
Mm.
You know, again, Rachmaninoff said, if I never make a mistake in my practice, there's a jolly good chance I won't make an error when I perform.
Yep, I've heard similar ones to that, yeah.
Yeah, and the second thing is when we talk about the brain that changes itself, to quote Norman Doidge, myelination of neural circuitry happens with repetition and slow repetition. Now, myelination is an insulator that makes the transition of data along neural circuits quicker, much quicker, and more accurate.
Mm.
And it only happens with repetition and slow repetition.
So I just to stop you there, because I don't want anything to go over people's heads. You're talking about myelination, which is, my understanding of it is anyway, if you're thinking about some connections between brain neurons or whatever they're called, there's a cable, and effectively slow repetition that's effective and correct will actually line that cable and give it more insulation and make the connection stronger. That's kind of my novice's view of it.
You've explained it beautifully, Tim.
Oh, beautiful, good.
The explanation, yeah.
Okay, good. And that only comes through slow, correct, repetitive, concentrated, deliberate practice, right?
That's spot on, yeah. You know. And this is what makes people intelligent is not how many brain cells we've got. In fact, we've all got about the same, apparently, about 100 billion. It's the connections between the brain cells.
Mm.
And you get connections by doing things. And you make strong connections through repetition. And if we go back to speaking again, which possibly the most complex thing we do is talk, most of us, the average is about 15,000 words a day. So we get lots of repetition, lots of practice doing that. And with slow skill development, we're not just talking about musicians. The ballet dancers do the same thing, swimmers, golfers in perfecting their golf stroke, gymnasts. There's a lot of examples of slow movement to get the brain circuitry right in the first place.
Mm. I have to say, I've been using a great app which you might be aware of called Coach's Eye recently in my studio. It's a videoing app that slows things down. Which means that you can step through motion and show students very clearly what's going on with their fingers. So I was working with one of my students yesterday, and we were working on positioning of the fingers, and movement away from the keys. So trying to stay close to the keys when you're playing fast. And it was great to have this particular app allows you to video once and then put the comparison below it once they've changed the process and run them both together. Fascinating kind of thing, but I guess that's not slow practice in as much as being aware of what happens and seeing it as you're moving slowly. I've been finding that's actually quite a useful tool in lessons. I don't know if you've seen or heard of that working before.
Well, not that app, but and I'm not actually teaching in the studio these days. But the fact is you've got students getting a perspective on what they're doing, and it's an external perspective, and we all need that. And that's why, just getting back to the teacher-student relationship for a moment, because it's related, what I advise teachers to do, and I know that in your preface you mentioned how do we not turn a lesson into a practice session. Well, sometimes, Tim, I think that's a really good idea. And I have advised teachers to sometimes say, okay, today I'm going to be a fly on the wall. Just make out I'm not here, and I'm going to watch you practice. You have a practice session.
I laugh because I've done it myself. It's so eye-opening, isn't it?
It is. It's a bit scary, isn't it?
It is.
And as I said, and you know, research studies will show that what teachers observe are all the things we don't want to observe. Students move on too quickly to a new section of music. They don't repeat. They start at the beginning every time. They don't practice slowly. All those, you know, the three golden rules of practice are not happening. But there's another way to do that as well. We could reverse the roles, Tim, and say, right, I'll take your books today. You can be the teacher. Sit over there. But I just want you to watch me. And I could make out on that child and practice. And you know, verbalization is really good too. So I might verbalize and say, right, Bucks, you know, G major minuet, start playing and play a mistake and actually go through, oh, I need to play that bit. Maybe I'll start from the bar before because I made a mistake there, and I'll do it slowly. So we're actually modelling how to practice with the repertoire, with the child's repertoire.
Mm. I could actually, you've given me another idea. You could do the same thing and practice poorly and get them to see if they can note what bad things you're doing, I guess. That's another way.
Yeah. And I've done that as well. And because what we want to do, Tim, is we need to empower students with the how to learn. And as we know, most children get one lesson a week for 30 minutes. So for 6 days a week, they've got to be their own teacher. They've got to, and that's where that metacognition comes in, knowing the how and the why of what we do. And teachers can promote this autonomous engagement simply by asking questions before they give the answers. For example, when I was a lad, and I had some great teachers, but I remember a lot of the time I just had to sit there. I'm a pianist, by the way. I just had to sit there, and I was the receptacle of my teacher's wisdom, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And he told me what to do and how to do it, and this was good and that needed some work. But there's another way to do it, because great teachers have people think for themselves. You know, what do you think? You know, what do you think you need to work on? How does it sound to you? You know, how would you practice this bit? Where would you start? Can you identify the mistake? So really, as we know, self-evaluation is enormously important, well, in anything really, not just in for the developing musician. So we need to ask questions and empower the learner to do the messiness of learning and to figure it out for themselves. There's a lovely saying from Socrates that I like. It's, I can't teach anyone anything. I can only hope to make them think. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the great Enlightenment educator, he also said, never tell a child anything that they can't find out for themselves. Deliberately leave gaps in your instruction to make them insatiably curious, so they have to find out for themselves. And curiosity, you know, if we can drive curiosity, that's going to drive learning, isn't it?
So. It's so important. And yes, I always endeavour to ask more questions than I state. And I certainly, even with interpretative things, from any age level, I'll always sort of get them to bring out ideas of what could be done and then go away, try them all, and come back next week and let me know which one you like the most. So rather than dictating, you know, this must be done this way, it doesn't sit well with me. Unless it's completely out of context, obviously, for the character of the piece.
You know, autonomy is one of the pinnacles of fostering intrinsic motivation, and that personal desire, I want to do this. And autonomy means giving some choice. You know, I have some say in what I'm doing. I'm not just a robot. I'm not just sitting here doing everything my teacher says. But as teachers, we have to know when to provide those choice opportunities. For example, students, by and large, I think are not good at choosing the right level of repertoire for where they're at in their progression.
Mm-hmm, so,
but that's not to say we can't say, look, here's six pieces which are about the right standard, grade six or whatever it is, which one do you like? So we find opportunities to give choice, but it's folly just to let them play whatever they like.
Absolutely. Can you talk more? You mentioned the importance of autonomy for motivation. And I just want to pick up on that because I think it can be quite difficult for teachers to let go. Although I think that's perhaps changing as the world's developing and educational practice and research are showing that it's important to do that. Are there other ways that giving students autonomy can help with their motivation?
Well, just to pick up on a couple of things you said, I think things are changing. One of the studies I read, and I think it might be a Gary McPherson study, but I stand to be corrected, was that studio music teachers are only asking questions about 2-3% of their utterances in lessons, which is pretty scary.
It is.
I hope that's a pretty old study.
Yeah.
Otherwise, look, there's a major way, and if I can just go back a step, because I did say that the model of intrinsic motivation that I like is a simple model. It's a tripartite model. It's got three parts to it. And one is relationship, one is autonomy, one is competence. So we mentioned competence, that if a student doesn't think they're going to get any better, they give up. So we must give them the tools to know how to make progress. Relationship, quite simply, if students perceive their teachers as being cold and uncaring, they experience lower levels of intrinsic motivation. So what do they need from us? They don't need maybe too much, but they do need to know that we like them, we respect them, and we value them.
Okay.
So that's how a relationship works in the context of intrinsic motivation. Now, autonomy, sometimes we have to provide a rationale because, as I said at the start, students will take on the values of their parents and the teachers. If they respect you, they will listen. And there's a lot of things that young people don't know where the enjoyment is. You know, we have to pull them along that bridge a little bit. And music theory might be one of them, you know. So as a teacher, I provide rationales to learn theory to my students by saying, hey, you know, we give you theory. We don't give you theory to make your lives more miserable. We give you theory because it fast tracks your learning. And how does it do that? Well, music is intensely about patterns. Music's full of scales and arpeggios and sequences and form. And if you can see those patterns, for example, if you know that Fur Elise is in rondo form, you've earned a 40% reduction on your learning, you know?
Yep.
It fast tracks our learning. If we're playing, a Mozart sonata, which is full of scales and arpeggios, we've come across these before. Oh, it's a big chunk, isn't it? It's not 50 notes. It's just a C major scale, maybe sequenced a few times, as in the C major sonata. So I think we need to do that as teachers. We need to give a rationale that students bring on board. Now, autonomy. I think one of the big things about autonomy is this mindset. And I don't know if you want to talk about that now, but
I've definitely growth. Talking about the growth mindset, I think is kind of really valuable at this point, actually, particularly as it relates to motivation, because it's a little bit of a go-to buzzword at the moment, or maybe it has been for a long time, but I sort of heard of it in the last year or two. I think it's valuable if you could explain a bit more about that.
Yeah. Well, I first came across it in about 2007, so it's been around for a while.
I'm late to it then.
I remember, well, a lot of people are, Tim, you know, probably more so in Australia than perhaps some other countries too, like the UK. I've done a lot in the UK, and they seem a bit more versed about it. What's interesting, though, with growth mindset is a lot of general educators are familiar with it, and I think music educators are coming along where I think mindset impacts music students more than any other student, and I'll explain why. I'll explain why now. Mindset. What is mindset? Mindsets are learning dispositions, and the person who coined the phrase is a Stanford University professor, Carol Dweck. And what she found was that essentially, if people believe that they're good at what they do because they're naturally gifted, it sets in train a certain learning set of learning dispositions and learning behaviours, and they're not pretty. If they believe that they're good at what they do because it's in, and this is the autonomy, they have the power to do something about it, then that's a very positive learning disposition. And that's what we call the growth mindset. I can get better through my work ethic. And I think of the words of Beethoven when he said, Prince, you are what you are by accident of birth. I am who I am through my own efforts.
Mm.
You know, he was effort-driven. And when I listen to the language of experts, be it golf or tennis or music, people talk about their work ethic. They don't go on about how gifted and talented they are. But unfortunately, in music, more than any other subject area, it is seen the province of a genetic disposition. And what's interesting about mindset is it doesn't actually matter what the truth of the matter is. It's a perception. Now, I know that you have listeners out there who believe that some people are born more gifted than others, and you have listeners that don't believe that. But what actually, the point is, it doesn't know what the truth is. So what we find is that students with a growth mindset, they persist, they work harder. Essentially, a child who, you know, if you're told you're gifted and talented, you'll think, well, I shouldn't have to work as hard as these other guys, you know, these other students.
Mm, and so if I do suddenly find it hard, I give up more quickly.
They do.
It's like, oh, I should be good at this. Why aren't I good at this?
We find a fixed mindset, those who believe they're gifted and talented, there's a real desire to preserve that label, to preserve the image. So, for example, in general classrooms, these kids won't put up their hand and ask a question because the teacher said, hey, you're really good at maths, you're really good at music, you're a natural. The kid doesn't want to spill that, right? So they don't seek learning opportunities in the same way that the growth mindset. It's fascinating stuff, Tim, and there's a lot on mindset. You know, your listeners can just plug it into Google and they'll get some, you know, some PDFs on it.
A
lot of people refer to it. I mean, I refer to it in a music context in you know, one of my books. Her book, Carol Dweck's book, Mindset, that's obviously the book where it all comes from, but you don't even need that. It's widely available, the concept.
Yeah, there's plenty of information online about it. There's some very good infographics about it too, which I'll in fact put some links in the show notes for it because they do make it very easy to understand. And I think in regard to talent too, my own view on that is I think with the reading that I've done, and people can see the books that I've read on this in my resources page, which we can put a link to as well, that some students seem to have a disposition towards learning particular things. That would be my way of looking at talent. So it's not that they can instantly play music easily. They're not talented from birth, but they have some have a disposition to being able to learn that kind of subject a bit more easily than other people, which means, again, they make more progress, they move faster, they kind of self-propel them, they get propelled along with their own motivation more. That's kind of my take on it. I don't know if that's scientific, but kind of what my reading is dispelled down to.
Yeah, I guess the question for me is, where does that disposition come from? Because what we do know is that we've apparently got about 22,500 genes, half from mum, half from dad. But there's never been a music gene found. We have music centres, receptive centres in the brain, but no talent gene has been discovered as far as I'm aware. And I think before we talk about genetic disposition, I think we're learning a lot about embryonic learning and early childhood learning. People who start early, people who get curious early, people who find the enjoyment of music early through experiences progress very quickly. And I think it might have something to do with earliest learning experiences. And we're still finding out so much about the impact of those. It's a really hard question to, you know, to say one way or the other.
Mm. And look, we're not researchers, so I don't want to get bogged down in it. Let's go talk about, I want to go back to real practical stuff. What about for the kids that are just too busy? And it is, I think that is definitely getting worse. Overscheduled kids who just really struggle to find the time. What advice do you have for teachers for those kind of students?
Okay. Firstly, kids who are really busy, I know some students are very busy, but the evidence is so many students are busy with, watching TV, computer games. 38% of 14-year-old boys in the UK spend 3.5 hours a day or more on computer games, Tim. And Facebook. And I do workshops in schools and we do an inventory on how to use on leisure time and how they use their time. See, so I guess I'm not totally convinced that students are using their time wisely. There's a guy in the US who said that the greatest waste of life occur with people's improvident use of leisure time. So the first thing is to help students commit their time, I think, to active leisure. And some of that can be, back to motivation, is about setting goals. You know, if students have goals, they're more likely to work towards those goals. So, and in music, that might mean a concert coming up. We know that students practice more before they go into a music exam too, the days preceding that. But back to your question, you know, what I think is important in music practice is, well, it's that question that Mr. Suzuki got, Dr. Suzuki. Sir, when should I practice? Only on the days that you eat. You know,
only on the days that you
eat.
Okay.
Only on the days that you eat. So a little bit of practice every day. And that's a commitment. So those students who feel time pressured, maybe we can negotiate how much time they do. The other thing is practicing in small bits. I mean, the power of distributed practice, which we're on about for 150. If you've got an hour to spend, you're better doing it.
I'm losing you. You're breaking up, Michael. So I might just get your answer to that. Well, actually, well, I wanted to talk about specifics of practice, techniques wise. But before that, I want to keep on this kind of motivation thing. And we mentioned parents before, so I want to talk about parents, right? I've got one reader comment which I thought was quite telling, so I might just read it to you. So the challenge is getting parents to understand and reinforce practice in positive ways. Some parents who haven't studied an instrument don't understand what practice really is and look surprised or say, well, we just want this to be fun for them, which is the first step towards Piano Quickly becoming not fun. I spend a lot of time developing information sheets and sharing ideas with them, but it just doesn't seem to connect with some parents. So what would you say about helping teach parents about practice? Should we be saying to parents, if we're finding that the student isn't practicing, hey, here's an idea. Why don't you set some regular time to practice and things like that?
Well, firstly, I agree with you. We have to take any opportunity we can to educate the parents, right? Now, for me, that might be writing a newsletter article, every release of a newsletter, you know, every week, about practice and a whole range of other things too. But they get your head of music to do that at school.
Or would this work for private teachers in their studio as well? They could send an email out. Is that a suggestion?
Yeah, that absolutely. And also, see, I get the issue. I more often where parents will say, I know nothing about music, so I just stand back and I don't interfere. Whereas certainly in the younger years, we want the parents to be involved. Now, you don't have to have music training to pick up wrong notes, to detect that something's too fast. People have very reliable tempo systems and very consistent tempo systems. We know if something's too fast. And I think if we can help parents understand the fundamentals of slow practice and repetition, you know, my mother used to do the ironing in the same room in the lounge when I used to practice when I was a boy. And she'd say things like, before I left, I'll just play my favourite piece again. Now, that's terrific because it engages me in repetition, if nothing else, doesn't it? I'm playing a piece of music again just before I leave. So I think I started out by saying that children will take on the values of their parents. So we do need the parents to be involved and to send those messages that, hey, music's really important, and to insist on practice. As I said, we might be able to negotiate, okay, we'll do 20 minutes now, but come on, we need another 20 minutes later this evening or at some stage. And what we also know about take commitment is that students who have a goal to be lifelong musicians, they tend to live that out. They stick at it. You know, students who say, oh, I'm just going to play till the end of this year, they don't practice as much, they don't progress as much. So having a long-term commitment is important.
Mm.
And that's where parents, I guess, ideally, before a student takes up an instrument, parents can say, hey, this is a commitment. You know, we do a little bit every day. Yeah, and that's really important.
Yeah, look, I've just been making some notes as you're speaking. I think what I'm hearing is that we as teachers should feel quite quite at liberty to say things to parents that we would assume they already realize and know. We shouldn't take anything for granted that they understand about music practice. And so maybe I'm kind of picturing this, perhaps if teachers who are listening don't already have some kind of sheet that they give to parents with expectations on it, they could do that. I like this idea of a regular, even just a monthly newsletter of, you know, goings on in your studio plus the latest bit on practice, or weekly, or however often it happens. So I'm just trying to make sure we keep the conversation really relevant and sort of things that teachers can go home and go, all right, I'm going to try this with some of my students next week. So I wonder, I don't know, we've talked about parents a little bit. Is there anything else you can think that's really concrete? Like, you know, go and try this next week if you've got a student that really isn't practicing when it comes to parents.
On the spot, I'm not sure.
I'd have to think. But just communicate. Yeah. Like, don't feel that, you know, you should be silent. Like, that's what I'm taking is just pick up the phone if they're not in the lessons with you. If they are in the lesson, get them over, show them what they should be doing each week. Keep them involved.
Have them even watch a lesson. You know, watch good practice as opposed to less effective practice.
Mm.
And even that very basic message of, you know, two things that I find parents don't always understand. One is that you have to practice anyway. You know, I always remember, Tim, I was in Dubai once, and I was actually having a beer with a test cricketer, a fellow that I know, and he really surprised the daylights out of me. Being a professional sportsman, he said, "Surely you don't still have to practice the piano."
Oh, is that interesting?
I said, How do you keep up your skills if you don't practice, you know? And it's because it was music. Some people think we don't have to work very hard, but I think that's part of the mindset. That's the talent myth, if you like. We are naturally good at what we do, so we don't have to work as hard. So we need to get that clear to parents that, hey, we all need to do practice, and something every day is valuable, that distributed practice. And that distributed practice is the second point, because I've met students, I've met year 12 students, Tim, who think that if they're doing an hour a day, that's 6 hours a week, if they do 4 hours on Thursday, that's great because they only have 2 hours to go and they can have a few days off. And that we know that that's less effective. So I think educating parents is a big one. Inviting parents to be a part of the practice, particularly with younger students, you know, we both know, and your listeners know, that once kids get a bit older and they're teenagers, they're becoming metacognitive, they're starting to think for themselves, they might want mum and dad to get out of the room, and that's fair enough.
Yep, excuse the doorbell in the background.
But the younger students, I think they need mum and dad involved, and I think the Suzuki model recognises that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I like, too, what you said about long-term commitments, the importance of long-term commitments in helping students have that more motivation again, but the importance of the parents in helping set that. I think that's really good because, there's not that many 10-year-olds, I don't imagine, who are already thinking, I want to be a musician for my career. But just parents that go, you know, we want you to love music forever. This isn't just for the few years that you're at school. I think that's really important. I'm not sure how to get that across to parents, but it's something perhaps teachers can keep in mind.
Well, you know, one thing I sometimes do with my talks, Tim, particularly if I've got students and parents together, I say, parents, put up your hand if you wish you've given up music and you wish you kept your music up. And so many hands go up, and the kids are looking around.
Yeah.
And if I just speak to students, I say, does anyone here know an adult who wishes they kept up with their music? And again, hands go up. So they know this. And I think by asking questions, we're drawing it out, aren't we? We're making it come alive to their experience that, wow, music is important. I tell kids about the deathbed studies. That, you know, how do people at that end of their life in the 80s and the 90s, how would they like to use their time again? And what we hear time and time again is, I wish I kept up with my music. That's the number one response. Mm. I wish I joined a choir. So the value, and I think, again, the value that parents take an interest, And it could be say, hey, that's my favorite piece. Or that's my favorite song. Can you play that for me again? Can you play that for the neighbor? And then the neighbor, you know, important adults in the child's life, play it for Auntie Joan. You know, it's giving performance experiences. Kids like performing and imparting that aesthetic enjoyment to others. They get a buzz out of that. So, and that ties in with goals too. You know, what are we playing for? Is there a concert? Is there an exam? Is there something to aim toward?
All right. So I'm kind of making a bit of a list of ways to help students keep focused on their practice. So I've got goal setting down as one, and whether that is the next exam or is it's to be able to play a particular piece or whatever that is. So goal setting, working out the leisure time of students. You've really made me think about this one a little bit more. And in fact, Nick Ambrosino, who I interviewed on a recent podcast, he actually had a download. He had a sheet which was, don't think you've got enough time to practice was the title or something. And he distilled the life of a student down to find the time that they actually have. And as you've said, there is more time available than we think. So I think that's, you know, perhaps teaching kids, particularly teenagers, I guess, about using their leisure time effectively. I think that's something else we can definitely do. So that was number two on my list. Yep. Number three was modeling practice. So taking the time to actually show students in a lesson how to practice can be really helpful in making sure their practice is effective. And we talked about communicating with parents, however that's done, phone call, emails, whatever it is, but being open and ready to teach parents about music as much as you're teaching their students. So that were my kind of four steps that we've got so far. And there was a couple of little tips I thought I liked too, was your fly on the wall idea. I would almost suggest... for any teachers who are watching who have students who are struggling with their practice and don't seem to be very effective, try Michael's fly on the wall technique. Sit back and let them practice. And last time I did this, I said, all right, I'm going to let you practice for 5 minutes. 5 minutes. And they had finished practicing after about 30 seconds. And, they have no concept of time. So I thought that was really good. So that could be an action step that anyone could take. In the next kind of week, try it out, see what happens, see what they're actually doing, and then show them how to. All right, so I want to talk about just a couple of other little things. We've talked a little bit about ways of practicing, and you've talked about this idea of distributed practice. I've recently been reading more and trying more myself the concept of interleaving practice. Now, I don't know if it's a different name for the same thing, but so that's where instead of, for people who aren't sure about it, instead of just playing the same, let's say you're playing two bars and you're trying to get that right, instead of playing that, you know, 20 times correctly until it just is so easy, it's a waste of time. Instead of doing that, you only do it three times and you get it right just a couple of times, and then you move to a different chunk and you do exactly the same thing there, and then you keep moving back, and then you might go to a third chunk. And so it's meant to replicate more the performance model, I think. Well, what's your take on that? Have you seen that work in research?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a more mature practice technique, Tim. And basically, I call that spaced repetition. It's related to distributed practice. It's the same concept, but it's with specific, as you said, specific chunks.
Yep.
So I think one way to explain it might be, let's imagine I've got 30 minutes to work on my practice, and I think, okay, I'll spend 10 minutes on the Mozart, 10 minutes on the Bach, 10 minutes on the Gershwin. And that's how most people practice in blocks. And I used to play quite a bit of golf, and that's how I'd practice golf too. I'd hit 58 irons. Okay, I'll hit 55 irons and then another club in these big blocks. But the trouble with block repetition is it delivers sometimes a delusion of competence. We think we've got it, but we haven't. We haven't really nailed it yet. So the alternative is what you just referred to, interleaved or spaced repetition, whereas, okay, I'll do 3 minutes on the Mozart, a few minutes on the Beethoven, back to the Mozart, a bit of the Gershwin. I'm still doing 10, 10, 10. I'm still doing my 30 minutes, but I'm mixing it up. And my take on that is it works well with block repetition, because essentially to do that, I think we need to have a fundamental neural connection that's been made. So I've got the essence of the idea is there, and now I can embark upon the spaced repetition. Now, the research I've read has stated that spaced or interleaved repetition is twice as effective for memory recall as blocked. Twice. So, wow. And it's a funny little paradox in learning why it works. It goes something like this: forgetting is the friend of learning. The idea is that between the episodes of repetition, when we're doing something else, we're forgetting about the bark and we go back to it. And to go back to it, we say, oh, how did I do that again? And beginnings are difficult, aren't they? When we start, you know, when you get in the zone, you've done it 40 times, you don't have to pay as much attention to it. Now, when we learn something, we want to pay attention. When we perform something, we want to forget about it.
That's it.
What that automation, which is helped by that myelination of the neural circuit that we referred to earlier, that's where that's really handy. Repetition can automate processes. So you're playing Fantasy Impromptu. It's 19 notes per second. That's 380 muscle movements per second. It's faster than we can think. It needs to be automated. It's got to be practiced a lot of repetition and slowly, and particularly to get the four against three as well. But so that's a bit about spaced repetition. And you see spaced repetition I saw Tiger Woods practicing like that once on a golf course. He hit a few 8-irons and a few 5-irons and back to the 8-irons. So you see that in other fields. It's a strong way to remember things.
Mm. And so, yeah, well, and I love the idea that teachers could go and use this in a lesson with a student, perhaps an older student to start with. Try it out. See what the effect on learning actually is. Teach them this method. Come back the next week. See if they've found an improvement. See what the kid thinks of it too.
I like what you've just said too. Try it out. There's an old saying that you may have heard of: if you always do what you've always done, you always get what you've always got. So
you've got some great sayings, Michael, I have to say.
It's all in the book, mate. Have a go. Try something new. And the worst thing is you can go back to the status quo. But the difficulty thing with spaced repetition, Tim, it's quite difficult to do because it's not as intrinsically enjoyable.
No, it's not. It's really unpleasant, hard, isn't it? Yeah.
But it's twice as effective. Yeah. So if we can get our heads around that, it's really valuable. Mm. But you're in the zone, you're doing lots of block repetition, and we feel like we're making progress. We go, zibbity-doo-dah, this feels fantastic. So if the student is mature enough to bypass that feel-good factor of block repetition, then spaced repetition is the way to go. Mm. And I think most mature artists would do a bit of both. There's a time to get that neural circuit, isn't there, and just maybe zip it out 20 times. And then there's a time to go, okay, well, that's coming along. Now I'm going to introduce, psychologists would call it contextual interference. I'm going to interfere with my brain thoughts and forget about it for a while and then come back to it and have to scratch my head and reimagine the neural circuitry for that particular skill.
Yeah, I really like it. In actual fact, now that I've thought about it, of course, if teachers haven't done this before, try it in your own practice. And if you don't get time to practice, then find some time in the next week. Commit to half an hour a day. Try some interleaved practice or spaced practice. See what you think about it, because if this is new, this could be a really strong tactic you can use with your students. I like the idea.
And personally, I mean, how exciting is it for us teachers to learn new tricks and improve our practice habits? I mean, we want to live what we teach, don't we, Tim? You know,
totally.
Do these things and know that they work and live them, and then we can explain them and model them more effectively.
All right, well, I'm down to just my last question because I know we're running out of time, and it's about technology as a motivator. And I think particularly I've found for teenagers, I've found that incorporating technology in lessons can be quite motivating for practice, particularly when they're kind of backing tracks or they're playing popular music, things like that. But I wonder if you've got a take on technology as a motivator.
Ooh. Not really, Tim. You know, essentially, look, I understand that teenage boys perhaps more so than girls like to have technology in their learning, but I'm actually a little bit careful with technology in terms of the big picture of education, because the studies that very recently studies came out showing that Australia students spend more time at a computer in school than any country in the world. The UK came second, and there's they've gone down in numeracy and literacy, not up. You know, so why are we doing it? Is it effective? And technology, I mean, I love technology, use Sibelius and, you know, these sorts of things. But at the end of the day, it's not going to replace the skill work. But you know what? It might motivate. And having backing track instead of a metronome, that's going to give some maybe more pleasure to the listening experience. So, and you know, I think that's one thing, Tim, that, hey, if it works, do it. You know, if it works for certain students, absolutely fine. Most of us grew up without any of that. Oh, you're not as old as me, but I'm 52, and people of my vintage probably grew up without any of that. And, you know, but technology, look.
As long as it's not technology for technology's sake.
That's right. Yeah. It's how you use it, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I don't. It's like television, and we mentioned computer games. They're not good, bad, or otherwise. It's how you use it. That's what's important. So, if it's not distracting, and people are still practicing in the ways that we know work, we know repetition, slow practice, and chunking can't be replaced by technology. But the framework might be different and more appealing. So, if that works, then I'd give it a go. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, look, we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for all your insights. And I know you're incredibly busy, so it's fantastic that you could share your ideas with the piano teachers of the world. So I wanted to, you've mentioned your book a couple of times. So tell us a little bit more about the books you've written and things that people can read about you online.
Okay. Well, look, what we've talked about today, all of these topics in this book here. Can you see that?
Yes.
Is that okay? It's Learning Strategies for Musical Success. I'm really happy. I'm actually working on a second edition, but that'll take another year to come out. But it's all about the motivation of learning and skill development and how to practice and how to teach practice. So, and that's getting really good reviews around the world. American Music Teacher Magazine, some piano magazines, Clavier Magazine. And so your listeners might be interested in that if they haven't come across it yet. I'm happy to throw in a free postage as well for this deal of the day. That'll save $5 for the listener. This goes for about $34. Okay. I've got a couple of other books which may be of interest. This one here, Modern Harmony Method, is a good one for maybe classical musicians who want to embrace the world of jazz and pop harmony.
Okay.
Chord progression such as the 1-4-7-3-6-2-5-1, you know, circle of fourths, and how to voice chords. I find a lot of schools like this for the year 11 and 12 students, particularly those doing arranging and harmony. This one here, Bumblebee, is for choir directors.
Oh, yeah, I saw that online.
Saw it online, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's good we're speaking today, because this morning I got sent, there's an excerpt from here which is in the American Choral Directors Association monthly journal, which is a pretty big deal for me.
Yeah, it's great.
The world's biggest choral journal. And I had an email this morning from some gentleman who said he was a life member and he loved the article, which is very pleasing. That's got a lot of advice for choral conductors and exercises and rounds. And finally, I've got a couple of books which are specific on keyboard, general music keyboard pedagogy. When I say keyboard, I mean teaching music through the framework of a keyboard lab.
Oh, yes, okay.
And it's based on motivational principles of making progress. And students, they evaluate one another, so they can get teacher status if they can play something really well. And the other thing about these books, which is kind of nice, is, you know, you've got year sevens and eights in general music class who come from all backgrounds and all different levels. And these books, they take the kids where they are. You progress at your own rate. So that's motivational in itself, because you get that proximal rate of development where you're at. You don't have to keep up with anyone. You don't have to be kept behind with anyone. So
we might have to revisit that curriculum in group teaching month, which is coming up too on the blog. So that's great to know. And if people want to take advantage of the free postage, where do they go? Is that on your website only?
Look, the best thing is just to email me. It's through me. Look, these books are available on Amazon and certain, you know, distributors around Australia as well, and Alfred stores in the UK for your international guests. But the only way I think I can do the free postage is those who order through me. If they're internationals, I can help them in another way though. I can give them a discount through Amazon.
Okay. So maybe if people are interested, they can email you directly, as long as you're happy for me to put your email on the show notes.
I'm very happy with that, Tim. I'm always delighted to get emails from people who have questions too. I've got a Dropbox with articles that support what we've been talking about, probably like you have. And if people would like the link to that Dropbox folder, it's all good stuff. A lot of it's about the psychology of learning in general as well, which is applicable. Yep. I'm happy to send them that link to the Dropbox. They can help themselves.
Well, perhaps if I might get that from you, I'll pop that with all the other notes and links from today's episode. Would that suit?
Absolutely.
And then everyone can get it. Then you won't get 100 emails asking for the same link. Beautiful. Yeah. All right. That's great. So, look, I think we'll wrap it up there. It's been great talking with you, and I do hope that the people listening and watching have got some concrete ideas. I always try and make this as practical as possible. So, have a look through the notes on the show notes page and get in touch if you've got any questions. The show notes will all be live at timtopham.com. So thank you very much, Michael. I'll let you get off. You've probably got conferences or travels or something to do.
Great to talk with you, Tim. I enjoyed that. Thank you.
Fantastic. All right. And we'll keep in touch.